struts like John Wayne, resembles Jim Carrey, and dresses like he's visually impaired. Because he is. Insight. Insight with Mark Farrell on the Progressive Radio Network.
Yes. From the heart of Midtown Manhattan, it's Mark Farrell on Insight. It's the Progressive Radio Network. How are you, my friends? New York City is kind of eerie. It's kind of like there's tumbleweeds down the middle of the streets. Of course, that's an embellishment, but that's how it feels. It's so weird how the coronavirus, which we've been hearing about for the last 6, 7, 8 weeks, is in the center of the world in New York City. NBA postponed its season. No European travel. March Madness. It's going to happen. With the madness, of course, but no spectators. It's such a bizarre time. Uncharted territory we're in, certainly. And just the economic lashings that we're going to be taking. Unbelievable. Well, we got a great show ahead of us. How could we not? We're going to meet an author from The Haircut Who Would Be King. Robert Treber is on his way once he finds a studio here in New York. And we're going to talk about why he wrote this book. By the way, he's a great actor. And this is his first novel. And it's a great, great piece of comedy, satire. And here's Robert. Hey, Robert! Come on in. Make yourself at home.
Hey there.
Talk to you in a bit, Robert.
Hey there, right home.
Yeah, right on time there, Robert. Yeah. It's a great piece of work. We're going to get to meet Robert and hear how he is so brave to come into New York City.
Across the country.
But he's from Pennsylvania, so he's made of good core stock. It's interesting how in a matter of 14 days or so, 21 days, things have just changed dramatically here. But with Dr. Pence at the helm, I'm sure we have nothing to worry about.
God bless him.
God, every time I see this guy on camera. And Trump, did you see Trump last night? What was up with him? Was he heavily medicated? I mean, you know, the guy's out there on a good day, but last night I was just watching. My wife and I were like, what? Is this me? No, my God, this guy is totally out there. Totally out there. But, you know, it's just amazing how, first of all, I'm a realist. So when something like this, which is, again, very, very rare and uncommon and strange, certainly, in our homeland, is met with such fervor, and people are just obviously like sheep, and they just continue to do some things that are just mind-boggling, like, you know, buying tons and tons of toilet paper and paper towels and things of that nature. And you find yourself almost thinking, oh, I better actually start buying some of that stuff because there's nothing left. And the worst thing, and I don't want to be one of these broadcasters who instills panic, because that drives me nuts. For example, I heard a broadcaster on New Jersey 101.5 yesterday. Here was their lead story in their first sentence in their newscast. Man who has coronavirus explains it like drowning. So back this up. So the case is, and this was never explained until I read about it, that obviously if you have pneumonia and you have this illness, corona, there's fluid in your lungs. And yes, that can seem like drowning. But that's what they put first in their news feed. And it's so misleading. That is not the norm. That is the extreme here, folks. And I know that if you listen to the Progressive Radio Network, you're a realist as well. You understand, you're educated, you're enlightened. You understand that this is not something that obviously is going to take out millions of people. It should take out a few hundred, well, maybe 1,000. I'll get back to you on that number of certain people. No, I'm just kidding, you know. But reality is you just have to be smart. For example, I'm having a 93rd birthday party for my mom. Yes, round of applause. Okay, for my mom on Saturday. And there are three people that I unfortunately had to call up and say, you know what? I just don't think you should come, because they're in their 80s. And they're still rocking. They're in their 80s, and they had two had bronchitis in the last couple of weeks. So long story short, their immune system is a little bit of compromise. And I have two people in this my family that are siblings that are jet setters. So, you know, they could be walking Petri dishes. They don't know it. So we don't want to expose them unnecessarily. So that's like a logical precaution you should take, because I listen to the sane advice coming from some of the sane and few people that are the experts in this field. So onward and forward, New Jersey or bus for this party. And so precautions should be taken like that all across the board. Should we be hugging and kissing and drinking out of the same vodka bottle that we always do with the Farrell family? No, we'll all have our own individual vodka bottles. The other day, I work at another radio station. It's a rock station. And some guy walks in and goes, "Man, smells like vodka in here." I'm like, "Listen, let me tell you something. It's, first of all, it's Grey Goose and no vodka. I'm sanitizing. No vodka passes my lips at all. I'm a straw man. So anyway, just use precautions. Don't load up and take, 5,000 loaves of bread. Because you just have to be fair and rational. I'm sure it's kind of like a snowstorm. Actually, this is emblematic. Like when a snowstorm happens, and Robert doesn't know about this anymore because he's on the West Coast. But when Robert used to live in Pennsylvania, he knew when we got snow, people would freak out and, like sheep and herd to the stores like no one has peanut butter and jelly. No one has, God forbid you live without an egg for a day, It's just, this is like a microcosm of that exploded because people just are just freaked out. And this is not Armageddon. This is something, yes, this is something rare. This is something new. This is unusual. But, we're resilient. We'll get through it. We have very smart people in charge. Not sure where they are, but they're somewhere. And you are smart. And you can use your collective brain power between you and your significant other or others, because you're, who knows what you do. So I'd like to introduce my first guest today. Actually, it's my first and only guest. I don't know why I said my first guest. His name is Robert Trebor. He's got a great new haircut for the interview, and I appreciate that.
Yes, thank you. Is my mic good? Should I tip it up a little bit?
I wouldn't touch it, though.
Okay.
Don't touch it, because then you're going to have to go into
then
the
sterilization
everything.
Yeah, I know.
I just got told about.
Terrific.
My program director's got rubber gloves on.
Yes.
And some olive oil next to him.
Very nice.
So I was kind of like, I wait, from afar.
Yeah.
His new book is called The Haircut Who Would Be King. Wink, wink. You know who we're talking about. Robert Trebor is an actor. You know him, and we're going to get to what you know him in from. But he's an incredible guy, and he's done something that a lot of us would love to do, and took the time to do it in between all his acting stints because he was very frustrated. He couldn't believe what actually took place in November of 2015. The fact that Donald J. Trump actually became our president-to-be. So here he is. He's in our studio, and we're going to be talking about a book that tells the story of Donald B. Rump, that rhymes with Trump, and his comrade Putin, inspired by
Poutine.
Poutine. Actual political events, but wildly imaginative and exaggerated for comic effect. Welcome, Robert, to the show.
Thank you. A pleasure, and I hope everybody's healthy and listening and needs a good laugh. I actually have a last-minute breaking dispatch. You may not know about this, Mark. You may not know about this. This just came on the news. The coronavirus.
Hold on. Yes. We need a sounder like Fox or CNN.
Okay. Yeah. No.
We don't.
No,
go
this
ahead.
Came. This came directly to me from my sources.
Oh, okay.
The
great.
Coronavirus has just issued its own statement. It has a dispatch, and I'm reading verbatim now.
Love it.
The coronavirus says, "We are working diligently to control the scourge and pandemic of Donald Trump. Over 50 million people have been affected by Trumpism and Trumpitis. And this is far more widespread than the coronavirus, who feels besieged." So the coronavirus is standing up for its own defense. "And the coronavirus absolutely guarantees a vaccine against Donald Trump by November 3rd, Election Day. When you get your shot, you can remove Donald Trump from office and from the scourge." And ironically, 80% of people will have Trumpism or Trumpitis and remain unaffected. But 20%, especially the sentient and compassionate, may suffer long-term ill effects. So one palliative against this is to read my book, The Haircut Who Would Be be king, which modestly I plaster on the cover. One of the reviewers said, this is one of the funniest books I've ever read, unquote. So I thought your listeners would be interested in that dispatch.
That's a strong intro, Robert.
Thank you.
Welcome. Nice to meet you, my friend.
Thank you. Good to meet you as
so
well.
So you're a brave man. Thank you for coming across country.
For flying across the country with my wife, and we were fine, and nobody's coughing, and nobody was sneezing, and we will all persevere.
Well, going back to your statement, you know, it's interesting, and love to see the turnout so far for all this Tuesday, Super Tuesday. They're coming out in droves,
yes,
which is fantastic.
Yes, indeed.
People are fed up. I think more fed up than we realized in terms of actual numbers.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted to see that.
As
it's
am I.
And reminiscent of Obama era.
Exactly. And I think there were some people who were just fed up. I mean, Obama was a pretty damn good president, actually.
Yeah, excellent.
And the economy was good. But people,
in terms of the election, that election.
Yes.
That was record numbers.
Absolutely. And people thought, well, Trump could shake things up. And maybe.
He did shake things up.
He sure did. Like the plague. Maybe he would become presidential. Maybe the office, because they say a person goes into the office and acquires the mantle of, but that was ridiculous. His whole life has not been.
One would think so, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing in his life to prove that he would become anything other than the supreme egotist and pathological liar. And I mean this with no disrespect. I mean this as a factual description of the guy. I mean, pathological liar is not loaded. I think it's dead accurate. You
it
know?
Is. Absolutely it is. I remember sitting there, actually laying in bed. This is the one and only cruise I went on. My wife talked me into going on to a cruise.
And the last one probably,
yes,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. In 2015 to take her parents because they deserve a nice trip. And we did that. And we're sitting there. We voted before we left, of
course,
Robert,
good.
As you know. Where I'm laying there in bed going, how can this be true? And I just felt paralyzed, and we just sat there, laid there, and we're like, "This, how can this be true?
Yes,
this cannot
precisely.
Be true." So that was a turning point for me, my mindset in terms of the trajectory of America. When was it for you? Was it that actual night?
Yes, and precisely, that is exactly the way I felt. Depressed. Actually, we were seeing a comedy, a foreign film called... it was Tony Erdmann. It was a German film about, ironically, an imposter who pretends to be a social analyst and
love
he's
it.
Trying to ingratiate himself with his daughter. And we went out knowing that Trump was not going to be elected. So we came back 3 hours later to a store and saying, okay, how far is Hillary ahead? And the supervisor at the store said, sir, it's going the other way. I said, what? It looks like Trump is going to be elected. What? I mean, I was like, what the hell? So the depression afterwards, and in a way, I wrote this book to write myself out of the depression. Either you put your head in the sand and become an ostrich, or you just walk around angry, which is a rotten way to be. Or, in my case, I wrote a satire to amuse myself at first. And I showed it to my wife, and I showed it to my sister, and they said, you know, this might help a lot of people, Bob. You should write a story.
It's got legs, man.
Yeah, it's got legs.
And
yeah.
It seemed to be effective, because you are not a depressed person.
No. I refuse.
You are quite effervescent.
In the midst of all of this
spot
crisis.
On.
Yeah, and look, by the way, humor, apropos Dr. Strange, humor is not an escape. It's a way to absorb information and focus it in a more healthy and sane way, in a balanced way. Laughter is critical at this time. But people have asked me, is it dangerous to laugh off Donald Trump? You bet. I am not laughing him off. I am laughing at him. I am mocking him. I am satirizing him. And that has proven historically to be very effective.
You know, Robert, I remember this is the second time I was traveling years ago. We were landing in France, my wife and I, in Paris, because she wanted to go to Paris. And by the way, she was disenchanted. I took her to the world's most romantic place. And she goes, this is it?
Uh-huh.
This is a New York City girl. What do you expect?
And you're still together.
We're still together.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah,
exactly. I said, I actually like France more than she did. Anyway. Mm-hmm. We're in a bar across the street from our hotel. It was kind of late at night there. And it was announced that George W. Bush won.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all screaming, fuck Bush! Fuck Bush! Fuck Bush! So we joined in the giant.
You can say that on radio?
Yes,
my God bless.
Internet.
You know, George
Carlin.
Oh, right. Okay.
So,
yeah.
And here we are. I said to my wife, wouldn't you give anything to be back to go fuck Bush? Fuck Bush? Because...
Yeah.
I mean, he was dumb as a bag of rocks, but he was safe.
Right. And he had some decency. He had some inner decency. And he actually had a record of some kind of service other than to himself. Trump has always been Trump first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth. And look, if America's interests coincide with Trump's, as long as they coincide, he won't be against it. But him and his family always come first and always have. There's been no record of service, no record or of Eisenhower of military leadership. He's the first president who won because he was a reality TV star, for God's sake.
The only services of Twitter, because he's ready to tee off any second as we're talking
right.
about the next thing that's going to serve
Absolutely.
Him well.
Actually, I yearn. My dream is to be in one of his Twitter rants, because then the book goes way up sales
absolutely.
Go up.
How can we do this? We're doing this right now.
I hope so. I don't know if he's listening to the show. Do you know? Does he have minions who can convey this information to him?
Does he have minions?
Minions who might read the book.
Exactly.
The
well,
haircut who would be king.
We'll try to make that happen,
okay.
Robert.
Yes.
So at what point did you say, you know what, there's something really here that I want the world to see? Because now you're not a comedian.
Well,
but you have a comedic sense. You're an actor, a comedic actor.
Yes, I've done a lot of comedy.
Hercules, people should recognize your voice.
Salmonius, yes, the comic relief of Hercules, who always needed to be rescued. In fact, I was a spokesman for the International Rescue Committee. It was a
Fantastic.
Privilege. It was a privilege to work for them for refugee help and bringing people to this country, because my character always needed to be rescued. And in Los Angeles, I was like a celebrity. What I would do, I'd sign autographs and turn the money over to International Rescue Committee. So it was really wonderful to be able to use some kind of quasi-celebrity in a good cause. Yeah. So, the whole idea of being a comic actor primarily, and as I say in the book or in the frontispiece, the two characters I am perhaps best known for New Yorkers and others, the Son of Sam. I played David Berkowitz opposite Martin Sheen in Out of the Darkness. No laughs.
Great movie.
No
Great
laughs
movie.
In that one. No. So that
but
one
you
was...
You played your alter ego.
I did, yes. And as many people say, you know, actors often get paid for what would put other people in jail. So that was nice. So it was my springboard, and I got to Hollywood, and John Frankenheimer hired me for opposite Roy Scheider in 52 Pickup, and I worked
that
with
That was
all
a great
his,
movie.
Thank you.
I didn't
yeah.
realize that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I was one
wow.
of the bad guys.
I have to go back and rewatch that.
If you would, yeah.
Clarence Williams III. You know, whatever I can do.
Yeah, well, I'm getting like 10 cents a year for that one. That was like 20 years ago, 30 years ago. It was Clarence Williams III, John Glover, and I were proud, as Newsweek said, to be three of the most effective scumballs of 1986. I wear that with pride. So I played the psychopath, and then 10 years later, I played the salesman, the jolly salesman. Now, what
a very, very successful show.
Thank you. Yeah, that actually was. Yeah. I mean, 52 was artistically successful, but it didn't make a lot of money.
Was that your first movie?
No. My first movie actually was a film called Gorp with Rosanna Arquette. Gorp.
I remember
Do
Gorp.
You?
Yes.
Do you?
It was that 80?
80. 80 flat.
80 flat.
Yeah, it was the historic nature. It was the last American international picture, AIP, released under that banner.
I remember
before
that.
Before they were bought by Filmways and then, I think, MGM. So, yeah, it was what one reviewer said, Gorp makes meatballs look like Hamlet, which probably was not a big money
That's a
review.
Classic line.
Yeah, my parents saw it in Philadelphia with five people in the audience on opening night. And they said, my father, God bless them. They've passed since, but they wanted to be a lawyer. You know, they were not crazy about being in. And they were thought that, well, a first major part with Rosanna Arquette and Dennis Quaid. It was Dennis Quaid's second film. And they said,
wow,
well, this probably won't win any awards, Bob. And I said, don't be pessimistic. Every other film this year might be worse, which it wasn't. But okay, so having played the psychopath and then the salesman, Salmonius, for me, the intersection, think about it, audience, the intersection of psychopath and salesman is who? Donald
yes.
Trump. So I've got the internal cred. I'm not a journalist, but I mean, I've got the actors, know things sometimes on an internal level that factual people, I mean, it's important to have the Bob Woodwards and people writing about Trump and Rick Wilson from an internal point of view. But from an actor's point of view, I'm saying, you know, there was something in me that could play the psychopath, and there was something in me that could play the salesman, neither of which I've been in my life, nor have any of my family members. But in doing the research and about Berkowitz and in just watching Salesman, saying, you know, it's disturbing, but all of us have maybe more than a bit of Donald Trump in us. Maybe we have the compassion and decency to hold it in check, which he doesn't have. But we all have the capacity to be aggrieved and to want to get back at people who
True.
Have harmed mm-hmm. us. And how do you get back? I mean,
but
and
we
then
choose
all of
to
us,
take the high road.
Exactly. But it's tough sometimes. And all of us, look, you have to sell yourself as a radio guy. You got this job by selling yourself, I assume, and your rock position. To a degree, we all have to sell ourselves. But when salesmanship and the ability to lie pathologically becomes the paramount adjectives in our lives, that's dangerous, especially if you're president. So I wrote the book essentially as a palliative against that. I describe it as House of Cards wrapped in Monty Python on the way to Dr. Strangelove. And one of the reviews.
Hold on, I'm digesting
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's a lot, but
that,
that's
get the references.
That's accurate.
Yes.
That's good. I like that.
Yes. Yeah. Have you read the whole book? Have you finished the book?
No.
Okay. Well,
I read the one chapter that took me forever.
Yeah. Well, it's really short.
It was titled "The Election."
Yeah, I know.
And it was one page.
Yeah. No, it was one sentence actually.
One sentence.
Yeah. Yes. 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 I think actually just a couple of words. The election. A lot of blank. Sir, and
yes.
That was Rump One. Next chapter. So I keep them short and punchy, but one of the reviewers said, and I won't spoil it now because I want people to, you know, read the book. This book is funny and hysterical, but it ends with fireworks the reader can't even dream of.
Which we can't. We're not going to have a spoiler here.
No, no. So that'll encourage you to keep reading as well.
Well, I know the ending.
Oh, you do?
Yeah,
you're,
I went to the end.
Oh, you went to the
Come
end.
Come on. I'm a broadcaster. I'm not a dumbass.
Well, okay. Now you got to work your way up to the end because I think I lay it out in what some people have said is, yeah, we know it's satire and so forth, but given the president's behavior, maybe some of this stuff could have been true. I mean, early in the book, I'm going to do a reading tonight. We'll get to the address. Hopefully people can come to Shakespeare and Company on Lexington. But early in the book, I say as a nine-year-old, he was, you know, jealous and had a hairstyle fixation with Bobby Rydell and Bobby Darin. And at one point, he loses his hair to infantile alopecia. And he has a beautiful cousin named Tara. And he cuts off her hair and staples it to his head. Now, since he has a rather thick skull, it's not painful. But he staples it down, and people say, no, as far as I know, that's just my imagination. But given his behavior, it's possible that he could have done something like that. And so I'm trying to use a funhouse mirror and a prism to warp stuff. But hopefully it's not so far out where people say, you know, he actually, given his behavior in the past, he could have done this.
How much of the material that you have in this book was something that you pulled out of your left pocket?
Yeah.
Or combined with true events that you realize, wow, you know, sometimes like the comedians like Late Night Show, and I think you mentioned this in your material in your book that, you know, when he does leave, whenever that is, hopefully it's this year, in January, there's going to be a lot of less material, but that's what we want.
Yes. Yeah, I'm willing, you know, my book, were he reelected, maybe my book could become more saleable in his next term. Because ironically, a lot of the stuff that I mentioned, though I wrote it like a year and a half ago, and it came out just like 5 months ago, is still salient. I mean, the behavior that I'm mentioning seems like something he still could be doing.
Well, it's intensified.
Yeah. I mean,
he's having an inner breakdown.
Exactly. Exactly. And he's just surrounded himself with yes men and what I call the Trump poodle squad. He may not. I don't think he had any pets as a kid because they all would have died. He was so irresponsible. But now he has a whole Congress full of lap dogs.
Speaking of Congress,
their tails. Yes.
Do you think that was just the biggest laughing stock at all?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the ability. Well, I mean, I'm glad in 18, like 2 years ago, that it flipped to be a Democrat, so Pelosi is Speaker of the House. But, I mean, their willingness after calling him unfit, Marco Rubio, and all these people who said that he absolutely would be the most unqualified, unfit president in history, and now they've all become his lapdogs because their bases need Trump there for this stock market, except now that it's been plunging, you know, almost 20%, he's feeling really nervous about it. But yeah, I mean, they've just acquiesced. They've abdicated the responsibility to be a check on the president in favor of getting his doggy treats and being patted on the head.
That's actually a bit of a trait, a Trumpism trait, because they're all taking care of number one.
Exactly.
Except, I mean, this is why they're in office. They should be in office to serve the people.
Exactly. I mean, Mitt Romney showed amazing courage to be the one guy saying, no, he does need to be removed. Need to be removed.
I had an idea, and my wife and I were talking about, what do you think about, and I don't think it's going to happen now, but maybe a month or 2 months ago, if somebody made Mitt Romney their VP?
You mean the Democratic candidate?
Yes.
And I'd rather see him put a woman on the ticket.
Me
frankly.
As well,
you
but
know?
Just to guarantee a little bit of that cross-pollination Republican vote.
I don't know. Romney is tricky. He also voted for Kavanaugh. I mean, Romney does have some cojones. Romney does have some guts, but I don't know. I think that would really dispirit a lot of Democrats.
Who would you like to see in a VP?
I'd like
Biden.
To see Kamala Harris.
I would love to see her.
I think she's really fierce, and she needs a better hairstylist. I mean, look, I got to tell you, I'm in show business too, and let's face it, if Trump hadn't been on The Apprentice, if he hadn't been 12 years as a reality guy, he wouldn't be in office now.
Of course
Kamala
not.
Kamala has the guts, and when she was all on the committee, bravado, and she knows how to interrogate, and she's smart. But she needs a better hairstylist. She did not come off well, just on a superficial level. And I don't mean to be sexist, folks, because a guy needs to look really good on camera, too.
Absolutely.
Although Trump with his meringue orange hair thing, I love, by the way, when he was going up that flight of stairs, you can find this on YouTube, and the wind blew the back of his hair off, and he was bald as a cue ball.
Yes, exactly.
You got to look at that on cue. He really is a baldo.
Did you see him last night?
By the way. I'm not knocking that, but he's trying to cover it up.
But you're not trying to hide it.
Right, precisely. Yeah.
Did you see him last night on TV?
I saw probably some bits of it. Which one refer?
When he gave his address.
Oh, yeah. He also, for a guy who's been on TV, he doesn't read cue cards all that well. I mean,
it looks horrible.
Like he's reading, like he's trying to be serious, and he's being as kind of like trying, and it's hard for him to be, affect gravity. It's hard for him to affect gravitas, because he has none. I mean, assume a virtue if you have it not. But, and I'll tell you something else, since we're riffing right now. You know, Trump and I are members of the same union, Screen Actors Guild. Because he did a lot of commercials
and he appeared
in Home Alone. Yeah. And I really resent that my dues are helping to pay for his pension. So, but that we're both, fellow union members.
Interesting.
But,
I never thought of that.
Yeah. You're a member. I don't know if you are a member of AfterSight.
Yeah, sure.
Okay,
yeah.
So you're paying for some of his stuff, too. So he can help put more portraits of himself in Mar-a-Lago.
Where do I go from there?
Going
back to her stylist, it seems like she's sharing Hillary's stylist. But on that note, why now we're getting off point here?
We see how well that worked out.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Why in the hell is Bill Clinton coming forward and talking about this now?
Well, look, he has
What does he have to gain?
I don't think I think he's paying dues. I think he's paying emotional dues. I don't think he has anything to gain. I think he actually is trying to...
He must be going through something.
He's going through a late life crisis or something. And Hillary, I mean, I haven't seen the Hulu.
Can't be good for their marriage.
No, but have you seen the show on Hulu, the docuseries?
No.
I've seen some clips from it.
What do you think?
Well, the clips I've seen look pretty honest. I mean, they look pretty compelling. I don't think anybody's doing it to make points. I don't think they're going to sell a lot of residual. I mean, and I think Hulu is doing it, like The Handmaid's Tale, as a real expression of something genuine that society is going through.
Well, I never heard of a dishonest blowjob.
Well, sir, it depends on who you've seen in New York here. I've personally experienced it, but I've heard there are some dishonest sex workers out there. Not that I'm knocking sex workers, because God knows you're probably listening to this show right now. But I mean,
maybe that's what Trump can do after his presidency.
Yes, run a little brothel.
Yes,
well, I mentioned that in my again, it's not really a spoiler, but I have a chapter called Rump in Russia, Part 1, and I have him and Vladimir going into business operations. They own a hotel, a luxury car dealership, and a luxury brothel with red velour carpeting and, so
everything's brass.
Everything's brass. Yes.
Robert Trevor is my guest. He's the author of The Haircut Who Would Be King, and we are riffing on a lot of different things. And every author has a certain passage or a certain point in their book that they love that's really close to their heart. What's the book part in the book for you?
Well, and this is, but you asked earlier what came out of my pocket and what came out of some truth. Mentioned that Ivana, his first wife, said that he kept a copy of Mein Kampf by his bedside for a little light reading, as much as he could read, because he reads a paragraph here or there. And this is way before he thought about being president. He was told that he should study Hitler to learn how to manipulate crowds.
Do you know who told him this?
I don't. But Ivana has averred that it was by his bedside, and I quote in my book, and I'm really proud of this, being a Jew, I am privileged to steal from Hitler. It's only appropriate, I think, in terms of the karmic balance of the world since it went the other way for so long. But one of the quotes that I mention, and it's taken right from Mein Kampf, and I'm not plagiarizing because I attribute, is there's something Hitler said when he was writing the book, how lucky for leaders that men do not think. And that could be men or women. They go with their gut. They go with their bowels. They don't go with their head. And it's the leader's job, another quote, to focus the populace's attention on one common enemy and never allow anything to blur that focus. In Trump's case, it's the fake media,
sure,
or it's the Democrats. So those are two of my favorites that I have stolen from Hitler. And if the Hitler Appreciation Society would like to come after me, please. I'm all for it.
You welcome it.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just amazing how he's relentless on that.
Yeah.
And how many people, you know what's interesting?
And he may have learned that from Mein Kampf.
Yeah, yeah. Obviously, he's instilled it.
Yeah.
How many people, friends in Hollywood, association, business contacts, have you lost and or muddied the waters with this book?
Well, it's funny you mention that. I mean, Hercules and Xena were worldwide hits. And I was my privilege after doing Molière and Shakespeare, and not to knock Molière and Shakespeare and Chekhov, God knows. But this was a hit. And this got me around the world. I signed autographs, some for the International Rescue Committee. I went to Amsterdam and Germany. And it's so funny. I just parenthetically, in Amsterdam, I visited the Anne Frank House on the Prinsengracht, which is like a major canal. And it happened to be the day of the Gay Pride Parade in Amsterdam, and talk about cognitive dissonance. I'm there, and God bless the Gay Pride Parade, obviously.
Oh, sure, I'm all for it, man.
But I was there to instill the kind of compassion and quiet and drama.
And there was flamboyance everywhere.
And there's this guy outside the window. In fact, the locals who had been to the museum before just went to the museum because on the third floor window, they got a better view of the parade.
That's
so
hysterical.
I'm watching Anne Frank's, you know, behind her plexiglass.
What a dichotomy.
She has a picture of Queen Elizabeth and Grace Kelly. Her only entertainment were little snapshots of these people. And outside the window, guys were singing, "Wow! YMCA, da-da-da-da-da-da," in very loose loincloths.
Love it.
So talk about cognitive dissonance. But anyway, so Hercules and Xena got me around the world, and I had a huge number of fans. Now, on Facebook and Twitter, once I mentioned I was opposed to Trump and doing a satire, some of these fans started dissing me. I mean, people who would actually, I'd signed autographs. I wrote another book called Dear Salmonius, which I was commissioned to write when I was on the show because my character was Salmonius. It was like a fake Dear Abby thing. But these, "You're a really mean man, Bob Trevor. I don't know if I like you." And so some of these fans have really gone against me. Now, it's ironic because if you've ever watched Xena particularly, Donald Trump would be the warlord and the villain that Xena would fight against. So how can these people profess to love Xena and then love the villain that she would fight against?
Well, you know the answer to that.
Well, people are crazy. Yeah.
Well, No. You, in terms of stating what Donald Trump read.
Yes.
They don't think for themselves.
They don't think, period. Yes, they do not think. They go, there's a great line from, we're really riffing all over the place. So there's a great line from A Man for All Seasons, Henry VIII, when he wants Thomas More's support because he knows Thomas More is an honest man. And he won't just, you know, give the king an endorsement for the heck of it. And he said, Thomas, you're an honest man. I want your support because some people only vote, or not, you don't vote for king, only appreciate anything that moves. Anything that's flashy. And Henry VIII had supporters by fiat because he was king and he would kill them otherwise, but they loved him because he was flashy and he moved much the same way as Trump does. And that's why I say the haircut who would be king. I mean, he called himself the king after he escaped impeachment. He said, man, if you shoot at the king, you better get it. You better not miss.
And then what was the line after that? Heads are going to be on the pike?
Yes, yes, yes.
I could
yes,
not believe
yes,
he
yes,
was uttering those words.
Precisely. I don't know if he, I think his supporters were. I think he mimicked it. Yeah, some people say.
But still, why would you do that?
Well, because he loves the flash.
Heroism.
He loves the quasi heroism.
Yeah.
The kind of fake bravado. He didn't really want to be president.
Well, I thought he was going to say, you know what? I'm glad I won and back down. I really thought that was going to happen.
Yeah. I think people said, at least in New York Magazine, he wanted to run and then lose so he could have his own show on Fox News, since The Apprentice could actually make more money.
Yeah, sure.
But now, because he thought being president would diminish his income producing, but now he realizes he's not going to be impeached. It's quite fruitful, and he can do the emoluments clause. What are you talking about? I can improve my own. That's my job, to improve my own bank book.
And the thing that really gets me is the fact that here he is, you know, and thinking, and I understand what people were voting for. They want to change. They are tired. Both sides of the aisle are just tired of the same cut cloth, same mouthpiece, talking heads, etc. But at what point, you know, were people thinking, you know what, this person, I remember speaking to people, they'd say, I want to give him a try.
Yeah.
It's not a two-week demo ride. It's not a rental car.
Right. No returns.
This is a serious thing that can impact your 401k, your health plan, everything in your life.
Yep.
People don't have any, I think Well, hopefully now they get it. Like, people don't still understand, like, how this could have a financial impact, coronavirus,
right,
on Wall Street.
Right. And he's not prepared to. He's basically, aside from being unfit, he's incompetent. He has no. It's kind of like saying, okay, well, I know this brain surgeon has a long history, but I want to change. I'd rather go with a different guy because, you know, brain surgeons
younger.
Are state. Yeah. Brain surgeons are deep state. Their medical books are old. I want a new, impressive guy.
And we had a good talk.
Isn't right.
That his thing? We had a good talk.
That's
it went well.
That's right. I'm not thinking. My instincts are to go with him. Well, I don't know. I think maybe president of the United States may be even more important than being a brain surgeon. Not if you need brain surgery yourself, but in terms of the body politic, president is a pretty important job that actually has a skill set that this guy not only didn't master, has no interest in mastering, and he's basically functionally illiterate. He doesn't read anything.
Do you think this could be the one thing that could turn people away from him, against him?
Well,
coronavirus.
I mean, hopefully enough
and
in the electoral.
You think that's why he's having Pence handle
it? Oh, yeah, probably. I mean, the market is down to what? It's almost down to 20,000 now, and he's scared, you know, assless. Or shit, I can say this shitless.
Open forum, my friend.
Open forum here. I think, and he really wants to get reelected, not because he really wants to be president for another 4 years, but he wants to win whatever he perceives as winning, and he certainly doesn't want a Democrat to win.
Oh, I think he wants to be president. He loves the attention.
Well, now
the spotlight.
Yeah, but he'd get
Air Force One.
Yeah, and he can.
I call it Ass Force One.
Yes, and he can go to Mar-a-Lago and charge us for his pay, and so it goes to his properties, and it comes out of the taxpayers' docket as well, pocket. I don't know. I think he may, after this crisis, I'm not sure, because now he realizes, oh boy, maybe there are things I really can't handle. Because as having the greatest brain and the biggest instinct and more knowledge than anybody, maybe he realizes, uh-oh, I could be in trouble. And, of course, he's been exposed, right? From CPAC. People shook
That's
his
right.
hands,
yeah.
And he's not going to get tested because he doesn't want, you know, no, I can't take a test. Because if anybody finds out that maybe I've been infected, it might affect my ability to be, mm-hmm. you know, the number one guy.
He's been impacted a while.
Yeah.
What part of the book, as an actor, did you find that you could see yourself almost portraying?
Well, you really haven't read the Alex Clams part. You know what?
No.
You know who Alex Jones is, right?
Yes.
So Alex Jones is this conspiracy theorist who's like this real nutcase. Actually, the parents in Newtown, the parents whose kids were killed.
It's a shame.
Alex Jones said it was staged. Mm-hmm. They were actors. It never happened. And now they've been suing Alex Jones for infliction of emotional distress.
Didn't that come to an end?
I think it did, but now he's declared bankrupt. So he doesn't have to pay anything. But I satirize him. I call him Alex Clams in the book. And if this is ever a movie, I want to play Alex Clams because he sounds something like this. All right. Now listen. Today, college students are psychotic. 25% of all college students are psychotic, and they take antipsychotic drugs, which makes them open to liberal indoctrinations from their professors. We've got to stop this. And the way we can stop this is buying Clams suppositories, guaranteed to clean the filth out from the bottom up. And unlike other suppositories, these do not cause autism, blood on the brain, or narcolepsy. Now, normally, a box of 12 suppositories costs $400, but for my listeners today, you can buy a box for $299. Send your check to me immediately and save your kids from indoctrination from liberal people. Remember, they want to impregnate your daughters with race-neutral babies so the Democrats can have more voters.
Love it.
And actually, if you ever listen to Alex,
you are a talent, Robert.
Thank
Trevor.
You, sir. I got to tell you,
that's really good.
If you go to YouTube and listen to Alex Jones on YouTube, that was a fairly good impersonation.
That was very good. But also a little bit of a Russian there. Rush Limbaugh.
Yes, but it also, he really does sell all kinds of
he
crap.
He does. He's the guy's insane. I cannot. Well, that's the thing that makes me wonder, like, what planet these other people are living on.
Yeah.
I mean, am I shopping in the same stores with these people?
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
Yes, you are. And it's not just coronavirus that can, you know.
And I'm sure maybe I'm speaking for yourself as well. But remember, before this election, I just thought we were much more of an advanced society.
Yeah.
Racially, sexism, everything.
Yes.
And then, I mean, we have taken such giant leaps backward.
The majority of us haven't. Remember,
yes,
he lost by 3 million in the popular vote, which brings up the Electoral College conundrum.
Exactly.
But, no, I think the majority of us, and I got to tell you something, this is really hard to reconcile. What do they say? In real intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing thoughts at the same time and find the nuances between. I think much of his base, not all, but much of his base has an inherent decency. And if they see a person outside their law and a stranger or something, they will reach out and help that person and give the person bandages. And the basic human, we are all capable of both incredible kindness and decency and incredible cruelty
and selfishness.
And that is the human condition. And I don't know if you're religious or not, but that is why I am.
My religion is decency.
Decency in the human, but decency can be attacked from within by our own pettiness, by our own selfishness, and we have to watch against that and have some kind of inner compass, some kind of true north. And if we don't, then we're kind of screwed.
And that's where adultism comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Being an adult and being able to make informed decisions that will impact yourself and the people around us.
And the ability to grow.
Yes.
And this
and understand that you can make mistakes.
Yes. And I think Trump essentially is the arrested 9-year-old brat. And in fact, I think on the Howard Stern show years ago, when Howard said, do you think you'll ever run for president? This is like in 2010.
Yeah.
He said, look, Howard, I got to tell you two things. First, I'm the same 9-year-old I always was. Second, the stuff I've done with women, are you kidding? I could never get elected president. And then he and Howard had a laugh about that.
The guy's Kevlar. The guy, I just don't get it.
Yeah. He is the Teflon Don, essentially.
The pee-grabbing incident.
Yes.
And it's just, it goes downhill and downhill and downhill.
Yes.
You cannot wrap your head or sit down with the best comedians in the world a year ago or 2 years ago and say, what do you think could come out of his mouth or what events could be portrayed?
Yes. And they couldn't imagine.
No, they couldn't
come up with it.
No,
and in fact, apropos my book again, to get back to it, you know, some people. I think a guy from Esquire, Charles Pierce, said Trump is beyond satire. He is so self-satirizing. However, may I say modestly, I think I've been able to do it. I think I have been able to satirize him by putting him again in extreme situations against Putin and against his own advisors, where it is saying, "Oh yeah, this is satire." Although people could say maybe this could have actually happened at the same time, because he is so outrageous and so childish, not childlike, because childlike can be charming, but childish is like, I want what I want, and I want it now, and I'm not going to listen to anybody, and I know better than everybody. In fact, early in the book, he gets sent down to the principal's office. And in fact, being sent to the principal in fourth grade is called doing a Donnie, because he goes down so. And he proudly proclaims, I never read a whole book in my life. I don't need to. I know better than what those losers who have to spend time reading a book. And then I think Trump said like a couple years ago, he doesn't read because the brain only has so much energy. And reading would deplete too much of his energy to make pronouncements. So he doesn't want to waste his mind
by
reading.
How do you respond to something
you know,
like that?
You write the book.
Yeah. Hey, Robert Trevor.
Yes.
One man show off Broadway.
Yes.
What do you think?
Well, yeah.
You got the material.
I know, you got the chops. It's funny. You know, I did a one man show in Los Angeles about Brother Theodore. I don't know if this is in the press kit. Do you know who Brother Theodore was?
Yeah, I think
You're
so.
You're too
Remind
young. God
me.
Damn. He had a one man show. He's been dead now for 15 years at the 18th Street Playhouse. And he'd have an audience of 50 people. He was on the David Letterman show a lot. If you put Brother Theodore on YouTube, you can see this guy. He actually, this is a whole other show, and I did this in Los Angeles, and I won some prizes from LA Drama Critics Awards. But he would talk like this. It was crazy. And he would start talking to people, and you couldn't tell if he was absolutely nuts. And he would talk about it is not enough to be a vegetarian. What about the vegetals and the animals? The vegetals, you squeeze the grape and drink her blood? Give up food, my friends. Give up food now. Now, I would, at that
time,
I would I went through a series of girlfriends. I don't mean that, you know, in a sexual way.
I'm sorry to hear.
It was, but a template for a more permanent relationship was whether they could get Brother Theodore. And my wife, who I've now been, when I've been married 39 years, she got
him. That's a good litmus test.
It's a good litmus test. But it's like you couldn't, but if you went more than once, he was following a specific script. He wrote it himself, and he was a fugitive from a concentration camp. He was an escapee from a concentration camp. He knew Einstein. He had an incredible life. So I did a one-man show about him about, I don't know, 13, 14 years ago.
Successful?
It was successful. It was artistically successful. Like much in my life, except Hercules and Xena.
That doesn't translate into money like that show did.
That doesn't translate into pocket Hercules, rent. Yeah. No. Yeah. But it was artistically successful.
But seriously, I think this has some legs.
It may. Yeah. I want a lot of people to read it first, so I have a built-in audience. I want the built-in audience, and that would give a producer maybe for a film as well, because I'd love to play Alex Clams. But yeah, people have been mentioning that to me as a one-man show. But right now, it's been written to be read. There's a kind of energy. People say, what's the difference between acting and writing? Well, as a comic actor, there is pace. You have to
timing
learn rhythm.
Is everything.
Timing is everything. And I've kind of, originally, this is now 184 pages. You can read the whole thing. Mark in like 3 or 4 hours when he can sit down. It's not a long read. It was originally like 300 pages, and it was full, but I said, you know, it's breaking up the train. I want people to get on the train, and the train is moving down the track.
It's not that type of read where people are going to spend 8, 10, 12, 14 hours reading a book about Trump. They don't want you. This captures their, and I went through it and leafed through it, and obviously with the press material, and I knew where to go. But I think it's a great palette size.
Yes.
You know?
Yes, and it's meant to be absorbed, and you get the good of it in a relatively short time. It's not Fear. I mean, I read Fear. I read Everything Trump Touches Dies. Those are valuable books, but it takes time. You got to really devote yourself to reading it.
And
you have to be in the mindset to accept it. This, especially these days with the coronavirus, people need to laugh. I've done a lot of interviews where they said, don't talk about politics, which is a little tricky given the material. But they said, talk about the power of laughter. I just did an interview, radio interview, 2 days ago for a Connecticut radio station. And she said, yeah, I said, now it's more important than ever to have laughter in our lives. Again, not to avoid, not to put our head in the sand, but to just explode the mind with a kind of endorphin rush, and I'm going to get through this. We are not all going to die. And parenthetically, I can mention I was diagnosed with acute leukemia 8 years ago. It's better than ugly acute leukemia, I guess. But and I relapse, and they give me a 4-month chance to live if I couldn't get a bone marrow transplant. And during that time, I was in the hospital waiting for the transplant. I was watching Preston Sturges films and Monty Python and Fawlty Towers.
Good
and
for
even
you.
Though my energy, I couldn't get out of bed, man. I had to remind myself how to turn over. I'm serious about this. Take arm A, put on rail B, shift your legs this way. I was really depleted.
What a remarkable recovery.
The laughter gave me the energy.
Medicine.
And doctors, it's not just psychological.
No.
It's physical.
Oh, absolutely.
It gives your lungs and your heart the workout that you can't get from getting out of bed and walking around.
Well, listen, we all have go-to books, movies, friends, people that can turn our sour or dark mood around.
Precisely.
Right, we go to the movies because we want to feel something.
Yes,
we want to experience something different, and that's the magic of laughter as well.
Yes, and especially these days, given both the confluence of Trump and the coronavirus, and as I mentioned, which has affected or infected more people right now, it's Trump, and God willing, the coronavirus
and more lethal.
Yeah, and more lethal, yeah. Precisely.
Once a year to get on the comic note. Once a year, I get up on stage at the Gotham Comedy Club in New York City to benefit Laugh for Sight, which is an organization I'm with because I'm visually impaired. And we get Seinfeld, we get like A guys, and I host it.
Yeah.
But I get to go up there and I'm a speaker for a living. I when I'm not in radio, I speak to audiences on different topics.
Yes.
But it's just a great way to, it's almost like you're writing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you went from screen to book, and I'm going from audience, different audience A to different audience B, because it's about timing.
Yes.
And it's so, for me, it's so enlightening because it's so deprecating, self-deprecating, and I can use my shared experiences, and it's all about just putting it out there and just knowing what people want to hear and what they don't want to hear in terms of escapism.
Yes, exactly.
And it works.
And as the great late Mike Nichols said, when everybody laughs together, it's like saying yes.
It is.
I recognize that. I'm not a jokey guy. I mean, I appreciate really good jokes, although I'm not a jokey, and there aren't a lot of jokes. It's a situation, and there's a kind of comedic arc. So I don't do jokes, even when I was doing Brother Theodore. And I also wrote a comedy act for a wonderful actress named Deborah Reagan and myself here in New York in the early 80s. We played Catch a Rising Star. It was like a Nichols and May, Stiller and Mira thing. And it was just one of those things where I couldn't stay up till 3 in the morning. I mean, if you're going to do stand-up, you have to have a lifestyle.
It's a tough life.
It's a very tough life.
It's a thankless life. You really have to be committed.
Dedicated.
And, oh, my Lord.
And be willing to sacrifice relationships, too.
Because you sacrifice a lot of things.
Yeah.
Like and a home.
I didn't have. Yes. I didn't have that. I mean, look, being an actor is tough. Also, I hadn't happened to look like Berkowitz, ironically, when he was captured, if you look at me and at the New York Post at the time, he could have been my twin, which
was
really scary.
And better Bernard Goetz.
Yeah. But the Berkowitz thing. The moment he was captured, people said, "Bob, have you been having a?" I was working at a part-time market research thing.
That's funny.
I said, "No." And in fact, when I did the movie, one of the producer said, as part of his rehabilitation, we allowed Berkowitz to get out of prison to play himself.
Oh,
and it's like, wait, that's funny, but that's dangerous.
Exactly.
And so I had to say, wait a minute, I am not, because there was a guy, it was rumored, who came on set with a gun wanting to take me back to prison. And the AD said, Bob, we caught him, but be aware. And then they assigned a cop to me to take me back and forth from my apartment.
Then you knew you made it.
Yeah, right.
That was Mom, Dad,
yes,
I got security detail.
I got security detail, exactly.
That's
exactly.
Them. Well, being from Pennsylvania, you obviously were familiar with Berkowitz, who he was.
I lived in New York.
Oh, you were there.
I was here at the time.
Oh, great.
I was here at the time, and in fact, away from the book, I came with a girlfriend, my first real long-term girlfriend from Northwestern. We drove to New York together, and like the week the week that murders happened, not when he was captured, it said Son of Sam, and my girlfriend at the time, Joanne, said, I wonder if I should cut my hair. And I knew a lot of them said, we need to cut our hair. Then Joanne broke up with me 6 months later for another actor. And that breakup and the heartache gave me the insight how to play Berkowitz.
You're kidding.
No.
Wow.
No, that's the stuff you can't learn in college.
Because
it was like, when I did the research about Berkowitz.
Hard knocks, baby.
He couldn't get a girlfriend. Yeah. He couldn't get laid, that kind of thing. And when Joanne broke up with me, I would watch strangers, men and girls and boys, young men and women, holding hands and kissing, and I was alone. I didn't know them, but the anger and the rage I felt.
Okay, we're out of time now.
Why should they have this? Why should they have this? And something I lost, and that gave me the insight years later when Berkowitz was caught and I happened to look like a photo double. How to tap into that rage. And that's why I'm saying I understand Trump on a level that perhaps journalists don't. The actor, now the reason why Trump is a lousy actor is he has no empathy and no compassion. But an actor has to have the ability to put yourself into those shoes, regardless of what those shoes are. And that allowed me, plus the research I did, and Martin Sheen.
And your years of experience.
Some craft work, yes. But also working opposite Martin
Sheen.
Don't
minimize that. Come on,
no,
you're
I'm
good.
No, I'm not. Thank you. But working opposite Martin Sheen was such a gift. Because
it literally
was just, after the research, it was just, Martin Sheen wants to know about Bob Treber. The way the detective wanted to know about Berkowitz. Yeah, I'll tell you anything you want to know. So if you watch my Son of Sam stuff again, it's like, yeah, I killed him. Now, in fact, I got better with a gun. See, at first, I used a two-handed approach, and I was lousy. But then I got into a one-handed approach, and I was more accurate. You noticed that, right? So it was just Bob Treber wanting to impress Martin Sheen.
Wow.
So that's part of, I think, what made it work, because people said, he's not a monster, which makes him creepier, because he could be the guy next door.
How was it working with Martin?
Brilliant. I mean, absolutely.
I love him.
One of the great, great experiences.
Good guy?
Very good guy.
Yeah.
Very good guy. And ironically,
he seems humble.
Not just humble, but really a mensch, a real decent human being.
Great.
And ironically, I was doing the movie during the day, and at night I was working at Ensemble Studio Theater in Shel Silverstein plays, playing seven wacky characters, including playing a genie who comes out of a beer bottle who wants to give wishes for a guy who doesn't want wishes. He just wants to watch television, and I'm just going to be stuck watching television with a beer bottle for the rest. So it was the ability to shift out of this really intense Son of Sam thing and play comedy, which again is my default position. And working with Martin and having that experience. Now, this was like 45 years ago, 30 years ago, when I was younger, and I had the energy to work 19-hour days.
You still have the energy, my friend.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you.
You're healthy, obviously, now.
I am. Although, from leukemia, yes. I have something. Yeah, I got some residual medical stuff. Not coronavirus. Please come to the reading tonight. But it's called Graft versus Host. My body recognizes it doesn't have the bone marrow it was born with. And so it kicks up against it.
Give us the location and details for tonight.
This is Shakespeare and Company at 939 Lexington Avenue. That's Lexington near 68th Street, 630. The Haircut Who Would Be King. I'll be doing a reading. I'll be doing a signing. And a special treat. I wrote a song called All Hail King Donald. And I will be passing out song sheets and lyrics. We'll all have a little sing-along to warm up.
Are you going to put this on social?
Yeah, hopefully. Hopefully somebody will tape it. Oh, we're getting the wrap-up sign. I see.
Well, we should actually. This is a great platform for you to get notification and notice by Trump. Tonight.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully, yes. And hopefully somebody can come down. Also, I hope to be in Milwaukee for the Democratic Convention. I want to, not as a delegate, but to sell some books to the delegates so they can be on the floor and start
singing. I'm quite confident
the
you can.
Okay.
The haircut who would be king.
Yes.
This is something, your first foray, in real first novel.
Into fiction,
yeah,
yes.
Into fiction. Is this the first of many?
Well, yeah. I also have another book that is unpublished. It's called And They Pay You for That? An Actor's Unreliable Memoir, which is mostly nonfiction, but it's like, you know,
it'll do well in the industry.
Hopefully, yeah. It covers a 20-year period of my life from college to Hercules.
And Robert Trevor, acting wise, in the next couple years, what would you like to pursue?
I'm actually doing something back in Los Angeles. I'm doing a very serious project called Violins of Hope, based on a luthier, a violin maker in Tel Aviv who received violins from the Holocaust.
Wow.
They were both from survivors and people who were found, and the people who sent them saying, these must not remain dust. These must be played. This is it's a documentary, a wonderful documentary, but a playwright in Los Angeles has written material. I am playing Amnon Weinstein, the luthier, the four other actors who are playing other characters in the story, and we're going to have a live violin quintet playing opposite us. So if you're in Los Angeles, April 19th and 21st.
And obviously these violins take on lives of their own.
Yes, precisely.
Because of what they represent.
Yes. So
that's escapism as well.
That's the most immediate thing I'm doing. And then hopefully people will be listening to your show and saying, hey, this guy needs another comic role.
Robert Trevor, do you have a website?
I do. RobertTrebor.net. That's R-O-B as in boy, E-R-T, T as in Tom, E-R, T-R-E, B as in boy, O-R. My name is Reversible. It's a palindrome. RobertTrebor.net. And you can learn about the book and other projects and events, and you can have fun.
The Haircut Who Would Be King. Special thanks to Javier. Javier is a great guy.
Yes, he is. Indeed, he is.
Fantastic.
Yes,
you have a great spirit, my friend.
Thank you, Mark. I love your candor.
I love your acting chops. I love everything you're doing. Keep it up.
Thank you.
My name is Mark Fowler. This has been Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Gary Knowles next. Have a great corona-free day. Bye-bye.